A good snowy morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A world under the effects of climate change is a scary thing to read about, but now imagine that you're seeing it come to life. New York underwater, the Amazon rainforest collapse and drawing to brushland, and the Nile, a rocky riverbed. That's what you see when you watch the documentary 6 Degrees Could Change the World from National Geographic. Our guest this hour is the spokesperson for that documentary and a journalist, environmental activist, and author. He'll take us on a harrowing tour of the world as it begins to warm by 2, 3, 4, 5, and finally 6 degrees. That is, if nothing is done to curb our greenhouse gas emissions. I hope you'll join us this hour as we look at our warming world and what we can do about it. Tell us how you're shrinking your carbon footprint or get advice. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. We welcome Mark Linus. He's a National Geographic Emerging Explorer and spokesperson for the National Geographic documentary 6 Degrees That Could Change 6 Degrees Could Change the World. He's also the author of the book 6 Degrees, Our Future on a Hotter Planet, on which the documentary is loosely based. Mark Linus, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
I want to take a moment here and just listen to a clip from the film.
Our planet is at a crossroads. Global warming isn't out of control, but it soon could be. The warning signs are all around us. This is the challenge of climate change. What can we do about global warming? What will happen to the Earth if we don't? The temperature is rising. Each degree is critical.
Just 1 degree or so of
1 degree climate. Warmer than they should.
Bump it up 2 degrees.
3 degrees.
Threshold is about 3 degrees of global warming.
3 to 4 degrees of warming.
You're starting to look at 4 degrees.
3 degrees, 4 degrees, 5 degrees.
6 degrees is almost unimaginable.
A clip from the documentary from National Geographic called 6 Degrees Could Change the World. And Mark Linus, it's dramatic stuff, and what you see on there matches the drama of that clip we just heard. It's really visceral and pretty scary to watch. Was that the idea, to make it as hit home as hard as it could?
Well, I first wrote this as a book. And by the way, the book 6 Degrees is also being launched this week. And for me, it wasn't about scaring the pants off people. It was simply about trying to bring to life the best that science has to offer in terms of what the future scenarios actually are, because you hear a lot of sort of mythology flying around with global warming. And so I spent literally 2.5, 3 years digging through all of the main scientific journals and piecing together a picture, both based on computer model projections and on paleoclimate, so the study of past Earth historical climate, and trying to use that to give us a window into the future and to organize that degree by degree.
Well, it is organized degree by degree, and you go through each degree, starting with 2, because that seems to be a sort of tipping point as far as climate change. What starts to happen at 2%? Why is that number significant?
Well, the thing is, somewhere between 2 and 3 degrees, we don't know exactly where, and even that's an uncertain estimate, but somewhere in that range, we could see the positive feedback coming into effect of the Earth's carbon cycle actually going into reverse, so that at the moment trees and soils around the world absorb a good proportion of our annual carbon dioxide emissions. Instead of doing that, if the warming goes too far, they could then start releasing it. And the epicenter of that, as you heard on the clip, is the Amazon rainforest, which could transform, according to several computer models, from a thriving tropical rainforest into an arid savanna desert type ecosystem, thereby not only destroying a treasure trove of world's biodiversity, but also releasing a whole lot of carbon into the atmosphere and giving a further boost to global warming.
And that would be pretty significant. Isn't it something like 20% of our oxygen comes from the Amazon rainforest?
I don't know that figure exactly. Certainly a lot of oxygen comes both from rainforests, but also from oceanic plankton. And the thing is, all of these natural systems are endangered because of the warming, including in the marine environment too. We could lose most of the world's coral reefs very early on. I mean, even within just 1 degree of warming, and that is probably impossible to avoid because that amount of warming is already locked into the system. So we're going to have to, as conservationists, and as people who are concerned about nature, and indeed humanity is, of course, dependent on nature, find ways to try and stop natural species being pushed headlong to extinction by even the smaller levels of warming that's already in the system.
You do cover some of the climate catastrophes that we've already experienced, one of which is something that did get coverage in American press, but I don't think it got quite as much as you'd expect. It certainly was pretty compelling stuff on the documentary, Paris in the summer of 2003. It was an incredible heat wave. Can you tell us about that summer?
Yes, that was a heat wave which was really off the scale of what has ever been experienced before. In Europe in particular, in one single night in August 2003, between 2,500 and 3,000 people died. And they were stacking up in the mortuaries and in the hospitals in a way which no one could ever have dreamt of. And this was a catastrophe because what happened was there was extreme heat, and also Paris has these metallic tin roofs which are built for a colder climate. And people were basically being cooked alive in their apartments, particularly elderly people. And this was a tragedy which mainly hit the elderly and the most vulnerable when the whole political class was on holiday. So it created a big political stink in Paris and in France as a result.
And this was something which was unusual at the time. Paris, I take it, is not really equipped with air conditioning and all of that sort of thing, or this wouldn't have happened. But you're making the case that this could be the future of the summers in Paris as the climate continues to move in that direction.
Well, it's a pretty easy thing to work out, because if you look at the model projections for what the several summer temperatures would be, they equate to 2003 as an average summer by about 2040 with a 2-degree rise in global temperatures. So in the 2-degree scenario world, that 2003 heat wave would be a normal, if not slightly cool, summer for France. So you can see how the climate zones are shifting north in the northern hemisphere, and the kinds of climates that you see in, say, northern Africa, Morocco, would then be really established in the center of Europe.
Hmm. And speaking of Paris, another thing that's happening in France is the climate in the summers is getting warmer, and some of the grapes that they grow in the traditional southern France grape-growing region, it's not so suitable there anymore, and that climate has already shifted a bit to England, it turns out, and the documentary makes the point that the idea of a fine English wine might not be a joke in the fairly near future.
Well, it already isn't, actually. I'm no great wine connoisseur, but having visited some of these vineyards, they all tasted pretty good to me. And yes, the traditional wine-growing areas in the northern half of the Mediterranean rim, so I'm talking, Italy, southern Spain, southern France, these are the places where you get the finest wines at the moment, and these are the places which are going to be getting too hot and too dry to grow grapes in decades to come. And in just, again, the 2 degrees scenario, we will be seeing new deserts establishing in southern Europe. And that, of course, pushes the main agricultural regions further north, and it means that southern England will be in the same kind of temperature and the same kind of wine-growing region. And you can see this already. I mean, and you can see this in the film, I was helping one farmer in Shropshire plant olive trees. You know, this is in the western half of England, and he's expecting a Mediterranean-style climate there within a few decades.
And they're also planting champagne grapes.
That's right, and he's already got a pretty big vineyard, and he's already marketing the wines quite widely. And yeah, there's vineyards now right the way up into the north of England. So, you know, people often you often hear the climate deniers or mavericks or whatever saying that, well, weren't there vineyards in Roman times in England? Well, you know, there's actually a lot more grapes being grown in England now than has probably ever been the case before.
Obviously, you know, that's not a terrible thing for England, being able to do these different kinds of crops and things like that. The downside, obviously, is the areas of the world where they sort of get the business end of climate change, the flooding and the unstable weather patterns and all of that kind of thing. And the point comes up again and again here that the people who are going to be hardest hit are essentially poor people.
That's true. I mean, it isn't just a case of winners and losers in different places. I mean, interestingly enough, when we were filming the sequence in the vineyard in Shrewsbury, in Shropshire, we were doing so, and the night after there'd been a very extreme flood. The rivers had risen all over the roads, and there's a sequence of me paddling through this floodwater. So, and this was the beginning of a summer where thousands of people lost their homes as a result of flooding across England. And so, you know, what may be good for one person at one time is not good for another at another time, even in the same kind of location.
And you also make the point that 6 degrees, it doesn't seem like a lot when you look at it. It seems sort of the sort of temperature differential you might have from day to day. But you actually say in the movie that it's the difference between current temperatures and an ice age.
Yeah, the height of the depth of the last ice age, about 18,000 to 21,000 years ago, saw temperatures, average global temperatures, between 5 or 6 degrees cooler than they are now, and that, of course, led to ice sheets, all across North America and Northern Europe. So a very different climate from the one that we know today, obviously. And so you can sort of extrapolate. You just get a sense from that what a huge deal average temperature changes actually are, because it doesn't sound like very much. You know, it sounds like 5 or 6 degrees. Well, it can change from that from one hour to the next, you know, if a front passes through. But in terms of averages, even to see a world which is 1 degree warmer than now, you have to go back a million years. I mean, these are major, major changes we're talking about here.
One of the most interesting things to me was something you covered at the very end of the documentary about how this isn't the first time the Earth has seen climate change like this in terms of the warming, and it happened during the Cretaceous period.
And
we managed to rid ourselves of it over thousands, or was it millions of years, but now in just a little bit of time we're pumping all the CO2 back. Can you sort of explain that?
Yeah, that's a very important point in understanding the way that the Earth carbon cycle works over very long timescales. And again, this is a point which answers to all the people out there who keep talking about, well, isn't this just a natural cycle? You know, the Earth's been hot before. Well, you know, yes, it was, and the Cretaceous is a good example of a very extreme greenhouse climate, which persisted over many, many millions of years, and within which all of the species alive at the time were fairly well evolved. I mean, dinosaurs munching ferns at the poles, basically. There was no ice anywhere on the planet, and that's how things were. But the Earth system tends to remove excess carbon from the atmosphere so it doesn't get too hot for life. And the way that that happens is that it builds calcium carbonate rocks under the oceans, but it also makes coal and oil and gas deposits, which safely lock away carbon in geological storage over tens, hundreds of millions of years. What happens? Well, the temperature went down to safer levels, then humans came along and start digging this stuff up, burning it, and dumping this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the space of less than a century. And, you know, I cannot find a single geological analogy for carbon input into the atmosphere as rapid as the one that we're currently engaged in doing. Nor possibly a temperature rise to match. So we really are conducting an experiment with our planet which is unprecedented, even on, 100 million year timescales.
We're talking this hour with Mark Linus. He's spokesperson for the National Geographic documentary 6 Degrees Could Change the World. Also the author of the book 6 Degrees, Our Future on a Hotter Planet. Let's listen to one more clip here as we go into our break. Here's a clip from 6 Degrees Could Change the World.
We are very close to the slippery slope right now. Some scientists already say it's probably too late to save the Arctic. I don't agree with that, but I do think we're very close to going to a situation where we would have no ice in the Arctic in the warm season.
This could be where global warming becomes a runaway train. Warming accelerates the loss of polar ice. The loss of ice accelerates warming. More water from melting ice absorbs more of the sun's heat, melting the ice sheet and heating the planet even faster.
A clip from the documentary 6 Degrees Could Change the World from National Geographic. We'll be back with Mark Linus in just a moment, but I hope you'll join in our conversation this hour and tell us how you're thinking about global climate change. Are you trying to plan ahead? Do you have plans for reducing your own carbon footprint? Or do you just want to know more about the science? Mark Linus is the guy to talk to there. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickard, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 12:30 on Chapter a Day, Jim Fleming reads from American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic by Joseph J. Ellis. That's Chapter a Day at 12:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard, keeping you company today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking this hour about global climate change with our guest Mark Linus. He's a National Geographic Emerging Explorer and spokesperson for the National Geographic documentary, 6 Degrees Could Change the World. And Mark Linus, we have some callers waiting to talk to you, so I'm going to go ahead and take Boyd from Madison. Hi, Boyd. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Veronica, and hello to your guest. Actually, I'm calling from Milwaukee, but I wanted to.
Sorry,
why I wanted
about
to that. Oh, no worries. There's a reason why I wanted to point that out is because, well, today we're being hit with a major snowstorm, and why I wanted to address that is because I do wholeheartedly believe in global warming, and we need to be concerned about the environment. But I've noticed, in particular, this past winter, a lot of the extreme winter that we've had in Wisconsin, and I feel, and maybe I'm just going out on a limb, that this is sort of the elements sort of having just an extreme backlash to what has been going on. I think in all four seasons, we haven't had any stability. It's always been something where the pendulum is swinging one way or the other. Do you think what I'm saying is relevant, or am I just pretty much out there?
So Boyd, you're saying you think you're seeing the beginnings of climate change here in Wisconsin. Is that sound scientifically like something that's happening, Mark Linus?
Well, of course, we're seeing climate change affecting the entire planet now, because the average global temperature is already close to a degree warmer than it would be under natural circumstances. So all of our weather is to some extent human influenced. But that doesn't mean to say you can point at any particular event and say that's global warming and nothing else, and I'm not suggesting that your caller is saying that is, but the best way to understand it is that there's more energy in the system. You know, we're trapping, with higher levels of greenhouse gases, trapping more of the sun's heat in the atmosphere. That allows more evaporation and more precipitation to happen more quickly and more intensely. And so this is why you get the stronger floods, the stronger droughts, and you potentially can get, you know, harsher weather sweeping down from the north and penetrating further south. I mean, it's really anybody's guess how these things can manifest themselves. I certainly wouldn't expect to see colder than average temperatures across the whole of the globe. That would be very, very unlikely to happen as a result of what we're seeing. But certainly you could see cold snaps in certain areas which are related to the fact that there's more energy in the system overall.
In terms of Wisconsin specifically, we're in the Midwest, we're in the heartland of the United States, and I suppose insulated at least from the oceanic currents that buffet the coast. What sorts of things can the Midwest expect in terms of, let's say, 2 degrees of climate change?
Well, certainly, since you're in a continental climate, certainly the extremes of high summer temperatures are what I would look at. I mean, we have a case study, as you mentioned earlier on, about Paris and about how it's going to get that much hotter in the continental climate of Europe. I would expect the same kinds of things to be the case in the United States as well, and also possibly a drying trend. That might be further west from where you are. We talked particularly about Nebraska, which is an area which had deserts in the past, and these deserts could reemerge with just another degree or so of warming from now. And there's this whole area stabilized sand dunes extends from Texas right up to the Canadian border, so it's a very substantial portion of the plain states, in fact, could be affected by new deserts within just a short amount of warming from now. But it's very, I mean, you have to look at the precipitation trend projections for particular places, and different models show different things, so it's difficult to tell with any precision what's going to happen in any particular location.
Thanks a lot for that call, Boyd, and let's take one from Jim in Delafield. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I think that, I am dismayed at the fact that our government at any level, governments at any level in the United States, have done so little to conserve energy and to assist in conserving energy and to provide a structure where people, you keep talking about everybody's individual footprint, but you need leadership that will provide large-scale conservation efforts that can do two things. One is it can limit, we hope, the effects of global warming. The other is that we're supposed to be at war, and we're consuming so much energy, and even in the war, but regardless of that, if we're at war, why aren't we conserving just for the sake of conserving money in the United States? And a couple of the ways that that could be done. And I've seen this has been done in the United States before, is to go to a national 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. That's one thing that we could possibly do. The other is to encourage businesses and industries to advertise less in the lighting that they use, the electricity that they use, just to light an advertisement out front of a store or something of that nature. And those are only two of the myriad of things that could be done. And I speak from experience here, because I happen to be an energy manager, and today in Oconomowoc, we have all of our schools shut down and shut to an unoccupied setting, which means we've turned our fans off, our boilers are down, we're conserving as much as we can, because it's good for our school district and it's good for our community. But these kinds of things, this type of conservation is what saves energy. It's not energy efficiency. Energy efficiency gives people the false impression, I think, that they're saving energy, when in fact they are using energy-efficient equipment, but conservation is what really saves, because you're not using any energy at that time. And I'd like Mark to just address that issue and the political aspects of it and what we need to do from a worldwide political point of view. And I thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim. Mark Linus?
I think those are all very good points. And your caller there was mentioning the governmental side of this, and that really is crucial, intergovernmental, in fact, that you have to have an international agreement on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which all countries have to meet targets to differing degrees depending on their levels of development. But it doesn't make sense for any country to go it alone on this. You have to have targets which put a price on carbon throughout the whole economy, and that then incentivizes the saving of energy and everything else. It's difficult to do this from the bottom up because the economics don't really stack up so well. I mean, to give you an example, there's a pub landlord who's not too far from us who saved a lot of energy by switching off his games machines overnight and turning lights off and everything. He then used the money to go and fly to Barbados, you know. So actually you can save energy in one part of the economy, and that can actually liberate money to cause more emissions elsewhere. Hence the need for a governmental approach where you actually know that you're cutting carbon across the entire economy and you've got some sense of actual targets there.
In terms of energy output, there is a scene where there are a couple of energy efficiency experts who visit just a random home in, I can't remember what state it's in anymore.
That's in Colorado, I think. And this is Amory Lovins, who's very well known nationally. Snowmass or somewhere, is it?
Right, that sounds right. And yeah. And one of the most interesting things that came out of that was the vampire uploads. Tell us about those.
Well, he was talking about the leaving of equipment on standby, you know, the little red light that's on your TV, which when it's not turned off at the wall. And his house is really interesting, actually, because he grows tomatoes and he grows bananas on the inside of his atrium, and his house is so well insulated that I don't think they need any heating at all, and the entire house runs on just something like 120 watts. I mean, the same as two light bulbs, and he runs his whole electricity system off solar panels. So it's pretty amazing that he manages to do this.
And so getting back to the vampire uploads, though, it turns out that wastes a huge amount of energy. And what should you be doing, unplugging your toasters and your clocks and your DVD players?
Oh, I don't think toasters soak up much power when they're not doing some toasting. But it's the electronic goods which are left on standby so that you can flick them on with the remote rather than having to get up. Those are the main things, really.
So some of those things, though, I mean, it's hard to... What do you do? Would you install, like, a power switch?
You can do that, or you can just switch them off at the wall, pull out the plug. It's a pretty easy thing to do.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that at our home, where everything is sort of buried behind. All our electronics are a huge, massive jungle of cords behind a great big piece of furniture.
Gathering dust. Yes, you need a sort of isolator switch to switch off the entire lot at once.
Right. All right. Well, thanks for that call, Jim. I hope that answered your questions. And here's one from Paul in New Berlin. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Yeah, I was wondering, with the melting of the ice caps and the rising of the oceans, and you spoke of the desertification, and I was trying to figure what was going on, and I'm looking for a little bit more information. I could imagine some plants being not tolerant to the heat and therefore dying off, and deserts coming in with shifting of the weather patterns. But with the extra evaporation from the oceans, it seems that that water is going to possibly support some other types of plant life a change of the types of plants that maybe are more suitable to the moisture that would be available because of the greater evaporation. And so it's just the basic nature's way of adapting and balancing itself out. What do you see as a scenario for the changes of the new, more humid conditions on Earth because of the heat and the greater expanse of water?
All right, thanks, Paul. Mark Linus?
That's another interesting question. And if you wind the clock back 55 million years to a time in the early Eocene when it was about 5 degrees warmer than now in terms of the global average, there was tremendous monsoon-type climates in Europe and also in North America. And in Spain, there's evidence that most of the soil was washed off the land by the sheer amount of rainfall that was coming down. And that's, of course, as you say, a direct result of there being more heat in the system and that driving more evaporation and therefore more precipitation. And we certainly do, it's certainly projected that we'll be seeing a lot more rainfall at the higher mid-latitudes as well, so right up to the Arctic Circle, where it's actually quite dry at the moment. But the question in terms of new plant ecosystems establishing themselves is how rapidly plants can migrate. I mean, it takes a long time. In the post-Ice Age climate, it took a long time for forests to migrate back north. You know, these changes generally take place over many thousands of years to allow natural species to adapt and to change their migration patterns and to change the relationships which bind them all together into the food web. So to do that in just a matter of decades is beyond the reach of most plants and most animals, which is why most of the projections talk about mass extinctions. We could see between a third and a half of all of the species on Earth being driven eventually to extinction with a rise in temperature of just 2 to 3 degrees. So it's very, very bad news indeed for the natural world.
We've been talking mostly about 2 degrees here, and as we said before, the documentary takes it degree by degree. Let's listen to a clip from the film where we talk about moving up to 3 degrees.
If the world warms by 3 degrees, the Arctic is ice-free all summer. The Amazon rainforest is drying out. Snow caps on the Alps all but disappear. El Niño's extreme weather patterns become the status quo. The Mediterranean and parts of Europe wither in searing summer heat. This could be our world plus 3 degrees.
And Mark Linus, a clip from the documentary 6 degrees Could Change the World. What needs to happen to prevent us from getting to the 2 degree mark?
We need to shift our emissions path very quickly if we're going to stay within or below 2 degrees. I think staying below 2 degrees is close to being an impossibility already. So 1 degree or more is already locked into the system because of historical emissions, which are already in the atmosphere. But if we can turn around this tanker, the global economy, within 10 years, so that's quite a serious challenge, but if we can begin to dip global emissions within 10 years from now, we can squeak below the 2 degrees mark. That would also require emissions to be cut by the mid-century, so by 2050, by between 50 to 80%, according to the best scientific projections that I've seen.
And does it look to you as though that's going to be possible?
Anything's possible, so long as we can mobilize sufficient political will. And I was at the negotiations in Bali, the big climate change meeting in December last year, and that launched the negotiating process, which is due to conclude in Copenhagen in 2009. And things will be different then. There'll be a different U.S. Administration, so we can expect to see a re-engaging with the international process. And the U.S., of course, has been the main obstacle to progress for almost the last decade. So we've lost a decade thanks to the obstruction of this country, or certainly of the president. I'm sure many other people have felt very differently about it. So that's going to change, and we could see then a long-term framework for targets. And the European Union at the moment is pushing for very strict targets, for 30% reductions amongst industrialized countries as early as 2020. So, it's certainly possible that the world can mobilize around this, but I do think it needs citizens to be very engaged in this process. I want to see 1 million people on the streets of Copenhagen in 2009 to demand that this deal actually gets done.
Do you get the sense that among those watching the global climate change political aspect, climatologist and activist and all of that, there's a lot of expectation internationally as far as the American election.
Everyone is watching the American elections because, you know, we know that it's critical. People talk about China, but really it's this country which is the linchpin here. If we get another president who follows the same line as the Bush administration and refuses to even consider mandatory targets, then China and India won't move either, and we'll be stuck with this same logjam for, well, and we will lose the opportunity to stay below 2 degrees, which then means that we possibly will cross these tipping points. So that would be a disaster for the planet. You know, the stakes are really very high here.
I want to go back to the phones and talk to Dennis in Madison. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was, going to make a couple of comments and maybe ask a question for thought. The man that calls from Milwaukee and said, you know, is this winter being somewhat more harsh than normal? I have talked to several elderly people, and myself remember this is a standard winter for Wisconsin in a lot of respects. This is actually where, I guess, where we grew up with this type of snowfalls and temperatures and such, and so this is not... This is actually back to normal. Then I had another statement was on your simulations and stuff. These simulations are theorizing the climate change over a period of time and such, based on millions of years. And I'm wondering is if you were to change that scenario from millions of years to thousands of years, what the outcome would be. And also back in the 20s, I watched a show on PBS that they had done core samples and different things, but in the 1920s, there was a temperature increase of a degree or two, and this is where we had the Dust Bowl started in the West. I'm not disagreeing. I believe we need to be good stewards, and pollution and these things are not things that we need to have air quality and stuff like this for the future. But I'm concerned about the emphasis that we're putting on this as being a catastrophe, something catastrophic going to happen in 5-10 years. When a lot of these scenarios have already been played out over the past few hundred years. I guess I'll wait for your response. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for calling, Dennis. Mark Linus?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question and a very important point. And we need to clarify that because your caller there raises something which I think is in the top of many people's minds. If you look at the temperature records for the United States continental area, the 20s and the 30s were a warm decade, and there's been some dispute about which is the warmest year, whether it's in the 1930s or whether it's in the 2000s. But that's very different from the global average. So the global average has not been a degree warmer. It may have, you know, temperatures fluctuate at the local and the regional scales much, much more, of course, than the global average. And according to all of the best science that we have with ice cores and everything else, you have to go back 1 million years at least to see a global average temperature a degree or so warmer than now. So we mustn't muddle up the changes at the more local and the regional level with the global average changes that we're talking about here. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that 1 degree global average change is something which is a total catastrophe. The real catastrophic impacts where we could see the collapse of human civilization, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, are in the worst-case scenarios of 5 and 6 degrees. I think 1 degree is tolerable for humanity. I think we can get through this. We can still grow crops, and we can still find enough fresh water, by and large. It's going to be much more difficult for the natural world to adapt to these kinds of changes, and that's one of the things that I most want to emphasize.
And we have to answer that a clip from the film talking about what happens when we reach the very end of the spectrum of 6 degrees.
Education, help.
If the world warms 5 degrees, two massive uninhabitable zones spread into once temperate regions of the northern and southern hemispheres. Snowpack and aquifers that feed the world's great cities, Los Angeles, Cairo, Lima, Bombay, are drying out. Climate refugees number in the hundreds of millions. This could be our world plus 5 degrees.
I think in a world which is much warmer than now, 5 degrees, it's going to be inconceivable that human civilization can withstand that kind of a climatic shock.
A clip from the National Geographic film 6 degrees Could Change the World, the documentary there. And Mark Linus, we've been speaking with him today, is a spokesperson for that film, along with the author of the book 6 degrees Our Future on a Hotter Planet. Talking about climate change this hour, love for you to call in and tell us how you're following the climate change debate. Not really a debate anymore at this point, of course, but climate change and what you're doing to reduce your carbon footprint. Are you worried about it? And are you following the science as well? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Veronica Rickert with you today. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 4 o'clock today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. Yesterday, nearly half the states in the union made their mark on the race for the White House. At Issue after 4, Ben Marins and his guests look at what the presidential race looks like after Super Tuesday. Veronica Rickert, I'm with you today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Mark Linus. He is a spokesperson for the National Geographic documentary 6 degrees Could Change the World. Also author of the book 6 degrees Our Future on a Hotter Planet, on which the documentary is loosely based. And Mark Linus, let's go back to the phones now and take a call from Roger in Iowa County. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about what do we do? How do you have any suggestions of even the people who are promoting conservation and awareness of global warming, for example, Al Gore's group? They're promoting it, but yet they're not doing much in terms of, there was the thing about Al Gore has the outdoor swimming pool enclosed and it's heated with gas or electric instead of putting in geothermal or solar. And I know he's bringing all kinds of people, the training groups, which all got brought to, is it Memphis, mostly by flight, where most of that training could have been done via the internet with no travel expense? Or what things did you guys do in producing your film that are more conservation-minded? And then bringing it down locally, even here in Iowa County, there's a group who are trying to start some global warming educational stuff. And I started saying to the group, what are things we could do? And one of the organizers said, well, what, are we all supposed to get electrical bicycles to drive around?
All right. Thanks for that call, Roger. Mark Linus, do you want to respond?
It's a very difficult one, actually, because we expect environmental leaders to be walking the walk as well as talking the talk, and that's quite reasonable. We don't, you know, no one's going to take lessons on eco-behavior from an out-and-out hypocrite. But at the same time, if you want to completely restrict the behavior and the movements of the people who are making the running in terms of raising awareness on this, and particularly, I mean, Al Gore, then I don't think you're actually going to help the outcome hugely. So I think, you know, I would defend Al Gore and other people's need to get out there and to spread this message. And, of course, I've had to grapple with this. I'm here in the United States. I didn't paddle across the Atlantic. I didn't come by train. I came on the plane, and I think it's important to do that in order to reach an audience of millions via this film and to fight for doing the promotional work. But, you know, the things you can do, when I travel in Europe, I would always do that by train, and I don't fly on holidays and so on and so forth. But no one can be an absolute paragon of ecological virtue, and that always leaves you open to attack. And a lot of these attacks on Al Gore have been from politically motivated right-wing groups trying to undermine him by shooting the messenger. So I think we have to not take that kind of thing too far either.
So you're saying the benefits of the message outweigh the means sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of omelet-eggs type thing. It's a paradox that in order to try and help save the planet, I've got to, in a small part, destroy it by flying across the Atlantic to raise awareness of this. But the timescales we're talking about here, you know, are very short. We need action within the next 2 years, and we can't very well mobilize and motivate people if we all just sit there at home. I mean, there's a lot you can do on the internet and a lot you can do on video conferencing, and I do that all the time. But in many ways, there's no substitute for actually meeting people and you know, the kinds of interactions you can have when you're in a room together.
Do you have a sense of what kind of impact you expect this documentary to have?
You know, I haven't the faintest idea. I'm new to the sort of the whole U.S. audience here. It's being broadcast internationally, so it's already been. I think it's being transmitted in Italy, Greece. I mean, almost every country in the world which gets National Geographic Channel, and so including in the UK, will see this documentary. And I'm very interested to see what the audience figures are going to be, because it's been, you know, it's difficult to sell this message. People obviously are very, very interested in global warming now, but people also are put off by anything which smacks of gloom and doom. And, you know, with the clips that you've got and, you know, the sort of catastrophes type stuff, people might switch off as much as they might switch on. So I'm interested to see what the result is.
Well, I think that, you know, it's hard to escape a gloom and doom scenario when you're talking about climate change, because that's exactly what you want to galvanize people. But I would say the way that the film is organized, degree by degree, makes it a lot more tangible than I've seen before. And I think, you know, I don't know if the clips express that or not, but I think it's a very, you know, a very immediate way of organizing the idea and getting people to wrap their minds around climate change.
Well, I'm glad that came through to you. And the film emphasizes, and I emphasize this in the book as well, that we're really talking about what-if scenarios in at the higher levels of warming, because, you know, we really don't have to ever experience these outcomes. We don't ever have to see the results of this experiment, because we can avoid these worst impacts by anticipating them and by changing our emissions path in order to do so. And I suppose that should be a much, much more positive message.
And, of course, at the end of the film, you talk about new technologies which could also go a long way toward helping us, including, some of the far-out ones were mirrors in outer space, but wind turbines, and also a really interesting-looking nuclear fusion device for way down the road.
Yeah, and nuclear fusion has been way down the road for a very long time. So I don't think that's going to help in the foreseeable future. It's always been 30 years away. Even 30 years ago, it was 30 years away. But, no, it's a case of scaling up the technologies that we already have. You know, 2 million wind turbines would replace most of the world's coal power. And is 2 million a lot, or is it actually a manageable target? I think it's probably the latter. We don't have to build that much solar power in the world's hot deserts to generate all the world's electricity. So, you know, the technologies are there. It's a matter of shifting investment flows to make these things happen. And that's already underway. Germany's solar power manufacturing hothouse of the world now, because they anticipated this in advance, and they've got hundreds of thousands of new jobs being created as a result of actually leading the world in this clean energy revolution. I mean, that's the kind of thing you hear from Hillary Clinton a lot, and I think she's right that there is a huge job creation potential and economic potential in doing this. It's not about making sacrifices and living in the dark in a cave.
All right, thanks for that call, Roger. And to Jan in Plymouth. Hi, Jan, go ahead.
Oh, hi. This is a very important topic, and thank you for having it. I wonder why we don't just do as much manufacturing and producing of goods here, because the fuel that's used by freighter ships crisscrossing the ocean, bringing in imports and we sending out exports and things like that, that is some of the dirtiest fuel in the world. Plus, we'd be producing more here, making more jobs available to people here, and correcting our economy to a good extent. And the other thing that we do when we take on ballast water in foreign waters is we bring in their funny sea creatures and then come back here, empty the ballast into our lakes and streams and pollute further. I wonder why we can't do that, at least have a moratorium for several years until some of this global warming is reduced. Thank you.
So some ideas there from Jan. How do those sound to you?
Well, I mean, the thing about invasive species, they're certainly a byproduct of world trade. And you can see this with some of the pathogens which are attacking plants and trees across the U.S. And there's many well-documented examples of this, of beetles and things which have come in from Asia, which are now devastating forests. So, yes, we could, by reducing trade and by being much more careful, we could reduce that kind of thing happening. But you need a certain level of trade for economic prosperity around the world. I mean, you can't go to a completely localized agenda, you know, because you can't grow spices and bananas and everything in the far north, to give you a very obvious example. So that can go so far, but I think it comes down to economics. It comes down to getting the pricing right and to making the people who are using carbon actually pay for the damage that that's causing. So it would no longer be cheaper to import huge quantities of goods by ship because the ships would be paying a lot more for their fuel. And you just have to restructure the economics and everything else will begin to fall into place. I believe it's actually a lot more simple than many people think.
Thank you for that call, Jan. And let's take a call now from David calling from Sheboygan. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I know that you're from the European Union, the United Kingdom, and those places hold much more humanist beliefs. But in America, a lot of people have concerns about individual rights and the government telling us that we can and cannot do things. How do you think that will affect the political aspect of climate change?
Mark Linus?
Yes, interesting. I don't think it's a matter of individual rights hugely because, you know, we all accept the way the market operates, but the market is a human-created artificial institution. And so, you know, I believe we can solve this problem largely through the free market by putting a price on carbon. And then the markets can adjust and people can change their buying habits and their consumption habits in response to the changes in prices. So I don't think this is about the government saying coming into your house and telling you to switch off your TV. I think it has to be one which you know leaves it up to the individual how they want to change, and by and large we can solve the problem while still doing that.
Okay, thanks for that call, David. And on to Jerry in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about the effect that the increase in the amount of volcanic activity has contributed to global warming and the amount of carbon dioxide in the air and things like that. It never gets discussed, and it's something we really can't control, I guess. But what percentage or what effect does that have on the overall global warming?
Okay, thanks, Jerry. So how big an impact does volcanic activity have, Mark Linus?
Well, volcanic activity generally counteracts warming, because when you get big explosive eruptions, such as from Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 93, I think anyway, in the early 90s, that leads to global cooling because that puts a lot of dust in the stratosphere and that cuts off some of the sun's rays. So big volcanic eruptions actually cool the planet for a couple of years afterwards. Volcanic activity releases very small quantities of carbon dioxide over very long time periods, but it's less than 0.5% of what humans are putting in the atmosphere, so it's pretty negligible.
When we were talking about the earlier time of climate change in which we had warming similar to this, which was way back in the Cretaceous period, what was the cause back then?
Probably much higher levels of volcanic activity and sustained over much longer periods of time. Some of the major mass extinctions, which were probably climate change related, at the end of the Permian period is a good example of this. Huge flood basalt eruptions, which released, you know, millions of cubic kilometers of magma, and that released a lot of gas as well. But again, over tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands of years. So what we're doing at the moment, we're very efficiently releasing a lot of geologically stored carbon into the atmospheric reservoir, and that seems to me to be without geological parallel.
Okay, thanks, Jerry. Thanks for the question. And we go to Cynthia now from Menominee. Hi, Cynthia. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, and thank you for the show. I just wondered if you had addressed some of the issues that were brought out in Leonardo DiCaprio's 11th Hour film about things happening much more quickly than we expect, a logarithmic expansion of this problem.
Are you familiar with that film, Mark Lucas? Or sorry, Mark Linus?
That's all right. Actually, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. Could you tell us more about it, Cindy?
Actually, I haven't seen it either, and that's because we can't seem to get it around here. But I think I've read about it quite a bit, and it has to do with the concept that things are happening much more quickly. They happen logarithmically, in other words,
not linear changes. You mean
yes, that you know, if things double, and then you know, 2, and then 4, and then 8, and then 16, and then. No, it's not that. It's times. It would be 2 times 4 to 16, and then 16 times 16. So the last hour, it's kind of what we're seeing with our population explosion on the planet.
Yes.
Happening so rapidly.
Yes. These trends don't go on indefinitely. The population explosion is due to level off by about mid-century. These things are not necessarily caused for instant panic. But it's true that that many of the latest, each time we get a new scientific paper out, it often suggests that things are worse than we earlier thought and are happening more quickly than we earlier thought. And a good example of this is the Arctic sea ice, the rate of disappearance there, because when I started working on 6 degrees about 3 years ago, the projections were for the Arctic to be ice-free by 2080 or 2100. And now it's being discussed, well, this could happen within 15, 20, 30 years. So things have accelerated in response, actually, to changes in the Earth system, which are happening a lot faster than the models or the scientists originally expected. So we have to up our models and up our knowledge as a result of what we see actually out there in the real world.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Cindy. We appreciate it. And Mark Linus, we're just about at the end of the hour here, but I want to ask you, you have made this your life's work, and it's obviously something you've invested a lot of your own personal energy in. You must be, despite all of this, it sounds to me like you're still hopeful, that you have hope, and I understand it almost seems as though if you have hope, you're hopeful about the potential of humanity. Is that right?
I think this does come down a lot to your view of humanity, actually. Do you think people are sort of selfish and greedy and will never change, or do you think people actually are a bit more rational and can see what's coming and will therefore accept changes when they're obviously necessary? And I'm hopeful because a lot more people are very aware of this issue. I should say, by the way, if you haven't already, when this program's actually going out, I mean, it's on National Geographic Channel at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, February the 10th. I don't know what time.
So that would be 8 p.m. Central for us here in Wisconsin.
Okay. So it's 8 p.m. Eastern and 9 p.m. Pacific. That's all I know.
Okay, so 8 o'clock Central. And give us the date once more.
On the 10th of February on Sunday.
On February 10th. Well, thank you so much. We wish you all the best.
No, thank you very much for having me on, and it was a great discussion.
Thanks so much. Mark Linus, the spokesperson for 6 Degrees Could Change the World, the documentary from National Geographic. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for production for this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.